not sure that I actually realized that we weren't communicating, but what I realized was that I was getting more and more frustrated, more and more resentful, that anger was building up in me, so that instead of just discussing something that maybe disturbed me at the time, I would stuff it down and save it, and then I would just blow up every once in a while, and that would always just devastate me, because it was way more, the reaction was way more than was necessary,
yeah,
for the hurt or the upset.
And your husband, did he have a similar approach? Was he someone who hated conflict?
Yes, totally. We just completely avoided it.
So you both suppressed everything?
Yes.
In a way?
Yeah. We did it pretty effectively. Except, as I say, every once in a while I'd blow a gasket.
Yeah. Mm. Did he ever blow up?
No, he
didn't.
Not as much? No, he didn't.
And when you blew up, did that push him away?
Yes, and I blowing up was, from my side, also pushing him away. I mean, he then kept his distance. I would always sulk for a day or two, just so he knew that I really meant it. I was very upset.
Yeah.
And then gradually, it's hard to hang on to anger, you know. It takes a lot of energy to keep it going over a few days.
So given the upbringing you had as raised as a Catholic, and, you know, you were raised in this environment where you thought it inappropriate to trouble people, for want of a better word.
Yes.
Actually, then finding yourself seeing a psychologist, which is how you came to experience the Orange People and the Bhagwan, I guess that must have been confronting in itself, going along to a psychologist and being in therapy and telling him about your inner world and your feelings.
Well, it was very confronting. Just to come to that decision to seek help, to find somebody, a professional person to talk to. But as it turned out, I never did talk to him about what was going on in my head, because I got distracted by these meditations of Bhagwan's that he was doing, and listening to Bhagwan's discourses on audio tape, and he didn't seem to care about what problems I had anyway. So,
in the late 1970s, the word meditation was not something we heard very often, was it?
I don't think I'd ever heard it before. And when this psychologist said to me, "Oh, we're going to do a dynamic meditation," I was just really like, "Whoa, what's that?"
You know.
This,
yeah.
But I stayed, and I was present. I won't say that I did it. I was more hanging back, being there but not actually doing it. And it wasn't the kind of meditation that perhaps people understand. I think most people understand meditation as sitting quietly with legs crossed and eyes closed and hands maybe resting on your knees. But Bhagwan had developed a number of very dynamic meditations. They were done to chaotic, crazy music. You hyperventilated, jumped up and down, screamed and yelled if you felt like it. It was a different thing.
Let's talk about the Bhagwan. Some people, depending on how old they are, would remember the publicity that the Orange People, as they were called, received here in Australia in the mid-1980s. Bhagwan, to me, looked a bit like Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the founder of Transcendental Meditation, with his long grey beard. But Jane, for those who don't remember him, I found some archival audio here, which we'll play. And this is about a minute of the Bhagwan extolling the virtues of being selfish and linking it with altruism.
To be selfish simply means to be yourself. I say to you, don't consider anybody else in the world. Just consider yourself. And in that very consideration, you would have considered the whole world. In being selfish, you will find all the altruism that you have been seeking and seeking and were not finding. Because the whole thing was upside down. You are told to love the neighbor, but you have never loved yourself.
So that's the Bhagwan. Now, back in the late 70s, you say you're attracted to this man partly because you had a good dose of Catholic guilt, yeah?
Oh, very big dose, yes. Yes, I grew up basically with a list of things you were not allowed to do. One of them was you were not allowed to be angry. Anger was a sin. It was a bad thing. If you sinned, if you were angry, you sinned, and then you had to go and confess it, and you felt bad about it. I grew up with a lot of guilt. I went to a convent school, so that it was a very intense kind of Catholicism, and I felt guilty most of my childhood about something or other.
So what was it about him? Because you've described him as somewhere between a holy man, a showman, and a con man. From the research I've done, when he first started out in India, he seemed to be someone of substance, perhaps even integrity, but he certainly didn't turn out to be that, did he?
As far as I was concerned, when I first heard Bhagwan, when I first met Bhagwan, when I lived in India in his ashram, for me, he was a holy man. Those other things, they came later for me. He gave a daily discourse every morning for 2 hours. You could meet with him personally. He would give you guidance. And he looked like a sage, like an old man. And actually, I was really shocked when he died to hear that he was only 59, because I could have sworn he was at least 89, because he looked like a wise old man. And for me, everything he said made sense, and I was totally fascinated and very excited. I thought, how lucky. I've found this great master. I'm one of the chosen ones.
Except when you got to the ashram in India, it wasn't exactly the spiritual experience you probably imagined.
I don't know what I was imagining. My idea of spirituality was definitely to be holy. So the therapy groups that were happening, the violence in these therapy groups, the sex, the nudity that was happening in these groups were very shocking to me. But I was already a disciple of Bhagwan by then, and I did whatever Bhagwan told me I should do. He told me I should do these therapy groups. I didn't question it. I was frightened. I didn't really want to do them. You're right, it didn't fit with my idea of spirituality, but I was a devoted disciple, and if my master told me this is what I want you to do, then I did it.
Now, you've made a point of saying that you weren't brainwashed by a cult, by the Bhagwan, but you did the brainwashing of yourself. Tell me about that.
I did. It took me many years to understand that. I wanted Bhagwan to be this great holy man, this sage, this godlike figure, this father-like figure who would guide me through life, who would tell me what to do, who would show me the way. And I, over the years, I invested a lot of energy. I invested my family, my life in what I wanted Bhagwan to be. And so it was, with each passing day, it became harder and harder for me to see through my own construction.
So a lot of self-delusion.
Enormous self-delusion.
Now you followed the Bhagwan to the United States. He set up what was called Rajneeshi City in Oregon. And I remember quite vividly a story that 60 Minutes did at the time. And when they did interviews with people such as yourself, the followers of the Bhagwan came across to me as complete sycophants. So although you say you brainwashed yourself, he must have been pretty good at brainwashing, though, too.
It's probably a two-way street.
Yeah.
He's playing his part in it. He's being the enlightened master who has all the answers. He has all these followers who are going along with that. So I think it's probably a two-way street.
Did it all go wrong because he moved to America, or do you think, looking back, he was always going to go the way he did, and that was to be a con man?
Hard to say, but definitely when he moved to America, it was almost as though he absorbed the American way. He became really a consumer of luxury items.
And you write about his 90 Rolls Royces.
Yes. And I think, as far as I'm concerned, the apple was rotten from the beginning, because it was an illusion that I was creating for myself. Also, I've come to understand that people like Bhagwan, who set themselves up as an enlightened being, a way above everybody else, they are very, very lonely. They have no friend in the world. Mm. And they get depressed. Some start using drugs. And I think over the years in America, Bhagwan definitely deteriorated physically and mentally.
Now, this self-delusion that you had was so great that, it culminated in you spending 2 years in a US jail for attempted murder. Are you able to talk about that?
Yes. This was a long, slow process. I get involved with Bhagwan, and I'm just a very excited, holy woman trying to be devoted and do the right thing. Over time, and particularly in America, I got more and more involved in what was going on behind the scenes. It's one thing I have to thank Sheila for, although my friendship with her cost me a lot. It was because of my friendship with her that I got to see what was going on behind the scenes.
Now, let's just explain who Sheila was. Some people may remember her because she came out to Australia and did a whole series of explosive media interviews.
Bhagwan made it all sound like a fairy tale, a kingdom without crime. And if it was a kingdom, the queen undoubtedly was a certain Sheila with a gift for offending people. People like Mike Willacy.
Good luck to you and your pimps.
A government minister.
Up yours, buddy.
And our own Ian Leslie.
What can I say? Tough titties.
Sheila was Bhagwan's personal secretary in Oregon, not in India. She became his secretary in Oregon. The ashram in India was on a small property in the middle of suburbia. When Bhagwan moved to America, the property was 126 square miles. It was huge. And in the middle of nowhere. Our nearest neighbors were at least 25 miles away. The neighbors were upset. Bhagwan had Sheila as his secretary. He trained her to be completely outrageous, to be very rude and arrogant. He listened or watched. If she did radio, he listened. He watched all her television shows. He told her what to do next time, and his instructions were always to be more outrageous. And I think Sheila enjoyed that. She loved being Bhagwan's secretary. I know a couple of years ago she did, in an interview I read in a newspaper, she described those years in Oregon as the happiest days of her life, and I think they were. She played the part with verve. Yes. But I got involved with Sheila in Oregon. And it was through that, as I say, that I came to know a little of what was going on behind the scenes. There were two things happening over the years in Oregon. There was a lot of conflict with the Oregonians, people who lived in the area, people who lived in Oregon. And that conflict became more and more as the years went by. Mostly because of Sheila and Bhagwan just pouring fuel on the fire all the time. There was never any interest in compromise or understanding the local people. And there was, within the community itself, there was infighting going on. There were different factions. And when Sheila began to say no to Bhagwan, his demands for more Rolls Royces and then very expensive jewellery, Bhagwan started cultivating other people within the community who had a lot of money and didn't say no to him. And so there was this conflict going on inside and outside. As part of this conflict, I came to understand that Bhagwan's doctor, who belonged to the other camp and was very, very devoted to Bhagwan, was prepared to help Bhagwan commit suicide. And when Sheila said to me and a number of people on the evening of the 5th of July, 1985, that the doctor was going to kill Bhagwan the next day, I felt absolutely compelled to do something about it. And the only thing I could think to do was to kill the doctor so he wouldn't kill Bhagwan.
It sounds amazing. And looking back on it now, I mean, how do you feel about those events, you know, 20 years on?
To me, it's still frightening to realize just how insane I was. Instead of just letting Bhagwan do what he wanted to do, if he wanted to commit suicide, then go ahead. No, I was going to save Bhagwan. I was going to save the world. This is madness.
So you tried to fulfill this by sticking an adrenaline-filled syringe into the doctor, but it didn't pan out that way.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness for him and thank goodness for me. My life would have taken a very different track if I had been successful. Luckily, I didn't realise it at the time. I thought it was going to kill him, but luckily for me, adrenaline injected in that way, it might give the person a big fright, but it's not going to kill them.
Nonetheless, you ended up behind bars.
Yes, in that moment when I attacked Pequon's doctor, I knew that I had to leave. I knew that I'd stepped over the boundaries, that I was as far away from myself and everything I knew to be right as I could possibly be, and I knew I had to leave. I didn't leave right away. It was seemed impossible to me. I'd lived with Pequon for 9 years, and he was my world. Yeah, Pequon, his community, that was my world. I had nothing out there. I'd left my family behind. I hadn't maintained contact with them. It took me 6 weeks to actually get it together to get out of there. And actually, again, Sheila was the catalyst. Sheila decided to leave, said she's leaving. In that moment, I knew, great, if she can leave, I can leave too. And Sheila left, and the next day I left, and a number of other people. Pequon was furious. He was outraged. Sheila was his voice, his face in the whole world. And if Sheila could leave, anybody could leave. And although Pequon had known about my attack on his doctor for 6 weeks and had not said a word, when we left, when Sheila left, when I left, he started shouting very loudly for the police to come. He basically blew the whole thing.
So you went to Germany?
First, I went to Germany, and more than 20 people left at that time over a period of a few days. And we, being from all different countries in the world, agreed that we would meet up in Germany first and then see what we would do next.
But for you, extradited back to America and in jail?
Yes. Within 6 weeks of leaving Pequon, leaving the commune, I was arrested in Germany, placed in extradition custody, and eventually extradited back to America to face the charge of attempted murder.
I suppose we could talk for a whole interview based on your experiences of being behind bars, but are you able to sum it up briefly for us?
Well, I was in a state of complete denial about any wrongdoing at that time, and so I can sum it up by saying I closed my eyes very tightly and I held my breath and I waited for it to go away.
Right. So what, you were like an alcoholic in a way, not facing it?
Not facing it at all.
So when did this, because you said that your book was not a cathartic exercise, you said you had processed all this before writing. So at what point did you confront that self-delusion and move forward, and how did you do it? And it must have been terribly difficult.
It was. My first arrest was in 1985, soon after I'd left Pequon and the commune. In 1990, 5 years later, I was married, and I was arrested again on a charge of conspiracy to murder the U.S. attorney. This conspiracy was all a part of that very, very mad period, dangerously mad period, just before I left the commune. But it came back to haunt me, and it was with that second arrest. Up until that point, I had just been moving forward, not looking back, slamming all the doors behind me. That, my God, thank God I survived that. Let's get on with life. But when I was arrested the second time, I knew, I just knew, I couldn't move on until I'd faced my past. And it was then that I began to go back and to look at what I had done and why I had done it.
What, with professional help?
No, I was very shy of therapists. I'd had
given what happened to you.
Yes, I'd had a bad experience, and I was just shy of therapists. I just started slowly but surely to put my toes into those murky waters, and slowly but surely, I learned to ask myself honest questions and to answer them honestly. I had always, when people asked me in the past, well, why did you go to Pequon? How did you end up there? I always used to say, oh, I was seeking. Seeking, that sounds really holy. It sounds pretty spiritual. But at this time, I realized that actually I had been running away.
What would you say to people who, because these days, you know, you get people who are dissatisfied with organised religion. They might turn towards alternative avenues, for want of a better expression, including pilgrimages to India. Are there warnings that they need to heed? What would you say to those sorts of people who are on a spiritual journey, if you like?
If there's somebody telling you what to do and how to live your life and how to reach your goal, then you should think about it. Because as long as you're letting somebody else tell you what's right in your life, you're not growing up. You're just staying a child. And I think the whole purpose of life is to live it, to come to terms with it, and to grow up.
What's life like for you now? You now are based in Germany, and you said you remarried.
I remarried in 1990, a German man, who turned out to be a real rock of Gibraltar. This is a wonderful man who's just stood by me through my whole process, also through the second arrest, everything that's happened. He's just been there for me without judgment. And this has been a very, very important thing in allowing me to look at myself honestly. Because in this marriage, I feel secure in the love of my mate. I know he's not got the sannyasin disease of running off with the next woman he's attracted to. But he's committed to our relationship. And so I feel I have the earth under my feet, and that has allowed me to look at what I have done, to process.
Are you happy?
I'm very happy.